Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. The show is heard on WBCQ, The Planet, every Tuesday. They change the time every Tuesday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and it reruns, and I have to double-check to see. I believe it's on Fridays at the same time, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but you can also hear it on Podomatic.com. Just go to Podomatic and put in Camp Constitution Radio, and it should pop right up, as well as our YouTube channel. We upload most of the shows on our YouTube channel, so go to YouTube and put in Camp Constitution, and please, if you do that, subscribe, view, and share the videos you see on YouTube. We were hoping, before I introduce the person who was supposed to call in, this show is brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. And next year's camp is from July 28th to August 3rd in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And you can find more about the camp by going to our website, campconstitution.net. We were supposed to have Debbie Bacigalupi call in, and she still may do that. She's calling in from California and has had some kind of problems with her car and is in a cell phone place. But Debbie had just returned from the UN Climate Conference in Poland, and she's written a few articles in the New American and has some great insight on that that event. The New American and Alex Newman, there's some great articles by both Debbie and Alex Newman in the most recent issue. You can find some of the articles online, thenewamerican.com. But another one of these globalist events where they're scaring people to death about climate change and global warming and the sea levels rising and the world's coming to an end, unless we give them unlimited power. And that's really what this whole thing is about, folks. It's always been about power. I remember back in the I vaguely remember in the 70s in my science class hearing about early 70s, I might have been 12 or 13, hearing about climate global cooling, and that because of all the carbon monoxide and the CO2s, et cetera, that we're heading for an ice age, and if we don't stop polluting, we're going to have no more summers, winters, the seas will be dead. And it's been like that, these scare tactics. They started doing this, I don't know if it was really from the early 60s with Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, she was promoting the banning of DDT around the world, and it was banned. And basically, if we don't ban DDT, all the animals will die, there'll be pollution, et cetera. So countries banned DDT, and now... as a result of that, a lot of people died from various diseases, from mosquitoes and other airborne insects, especially in Black Africa, where malaria was very prevalent. And of course, the DDT was not nearly as bad as they suggested. So they get rid of that. And instead of using it, what they used to do, folks, is that they didn't spray it on the fields and in the forest. They sprayed it around the villages and homes. And they replaced it with mesh. Well, mesh doesn't work all that well because the mosquitoes are thriving, and they're going to get you. And because of that, there's been thousands of people died every year from malaria because of the banning of DDT. And it was, global cooling. And it was acid rain, and it was, what was the other one? Acid rain and ozone depletion. Because of the hairspray that you use, ozone is depleted, and everybody is going to get skin cancer, even though that the increase of skin cancer had nothing to do with the sun. Most of the skin cancer was in parts of the bodies that don't really get much sun, unless you're out there bathing in the nude. And then, of course, all the trees are going to die because of acid rain. Well, in the 80s, I was a little inclined to believe some of that. And I distinctly remember there was a pond in the town of Milton, Massachusetts, which is very close to where I live. And I used to take my oldest daughter there when she was a toddler. And it's a nice little place. You could walk around there and skip rocks. And I didn't fish there, but there were a lot of people that were fishing there, catching perch and sunfish and bass and whatever else might be in there. And it was probably at some point, maybe a year after I was visiting there, that I saw this press conference by Michael Dukakis, who at the time was governor of Massachusetts. He later ran for president. And he said that acid rain has killed this pond. And I'm watching this on the news, and I'm thinking, gee, that's a shame. You know, it's too bad. We got to do something about this. But then, I don't know, maybe 6 months later or so, I'm back at the pond walking around, and what do I see but people fishing and catching fish? So somebody lied. Michael Dukakis lied. He never made up. He never said, hey, I was really wrong about this. I was fed bad information. No, he let the lie go on. And I said, something's not right here. I said, if he's lying about this, there's other people lying. And then it was the acid rain also was destroying the forest in Vermont. And I remember John Kerry, he may have been a U.S. senator at this time. It was in the late 80s. I'm not quite sure the time frame. I think he was senator from the late 80s. And he said the Camel Hump Mountain there in, I think it's Mansfield, Vermont. I'm not certain of the town. And they showed pictures of some dead trees at the top. He said, that's acid rain. Acid rain's killing these trees. Well, we kind of find out that it wasn't acid rain, but there were insects, some type of beetle that killed the trees. And insects do a lot of damage to trees. And insects don't thrive because of climate. Now, that's another thing, too. All the insects are coming back because of climate change. There's more insects. There's deer ticks and all this stuff. Climate change is responsible for everything. You know? So anyway, getting back to that. So I also remember reading an article in the Boston Globe, which is still, I think, the largest daily newspaper in New England. The circulation, thankfully, has gone down a lot, but it still is very influential. And it said that the maple syrup, or the maple trees in Vermont and in New England are dying because of climate change or because of global acid rain. And they mentioned that some of these trees have tomahawk markings, meaning that the and Indians 200 years ago were tapping with their tomahawks and all this stuff. Well, something did click a little bit. I said, you know, trees die. I'm not sure exactly the lifespan of your typical sugar maple, but trees don't live forever. They live a whole lot longer than human beings, but they don't live forever. So I said, something's not right here. And then I started going to Vermont in the early 90s, and I picked up a local paper, and it said something to the effect the largest maple syrup crop in the state's history. And the article came not from some right-wing farmer. There's still a few up there in Vermont. It came from the United States Department of Agriculture. I says, well, wait a minute now. I only wish I could find that article in the Globe a few years ago. Maybe I should do some research. Maybe I'll find it and compare the two. And I talked to some of my friends in Vermont at the time, and they said, you flatlanders would believe anything. So that's when I realized something wasn't right here. That I think we're being lied to. And then I befriended the late Dr. Michael Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman wrote a number of books, including Saviors of the Earth. He passed away a couple of years ago. He was a friend. He was one of our instructors at Camp Constitution, and he wrote a book called Saviors of the Earth. And Michael Kaufman was a scientist trained forester, and he was part of the Acid Rain Participation Project that was launched during the Reagan administration to study acid rain and come up with the problem and come up with solutions. The scientists, you know, there are some unbiased scientists, and that's what science shouldn't be biased. I mean, science is a disciplined search for knowledge, regardless of your political persuasion. And if you discover that there is acid rain, okay, what do we do about it? And the best solution, if you're a free market person, is to use free market principles to take care of the problem, not socialist principles, which is what the folks at the UN are all about. So he looked into it. He and his colleagues looked into it, and they determined that the problem is very relatively minor, that a lot of the lakes, because of the technology that we have fighting forest fires, the forest fires weren't as big, and therefore a lot of the lakes were reverting back to their natural high acidic level. See, if a tree burns down, the ashes go into the lake, and it lowers the acidic level. And he said that most of these problems can be resolved that won't cost that much money. Well, that's not what the narrative was all about. We have this terrible problem, and we need big government to solve it. We need to restrict people, et cetera. And that's when he realized that the science had been politicized, and he got more involved and did more research, and he became one of the great pioneers exposing this. In fact, back in the early 90s, he and just a handful of his colleagues stopped the biodiversity treaty. They just bombarded the U.S. Senate, and they were going to have a hearing, and his senator, Senator Mitchell from Maine, and they were all set to vote to ratify this biodiversity treaty when Dr. Kaufman actually got a hold of the treaty itself, and he couldn't believe what he was seeing. And he made a map. He and his colleagues put together a map, which you can find online. It's called the Biodiversity Map, and he showed it to Mitchell and said, "This is what will happen to the United States if this treaty's passed." Basically, it would have a good chunk of the country would have been off limits to economic growth or use or what have you. And the treaty was never ratified by the Senate. And he became he had to leave his practice, his job. He started a few organizations, and he traveled the country and other parts of the world warning people about this and using true science. And you can see a few of his presentations on our Camp Constitution YouTube channel. Phenomenal work he did. So that's kind of got me, understanding this issue a little bit. I remember back when I was a bachelor, I had some house plants, and I think one of them was a spider plant. And all winter long, they didn't get a whole lot of sun. I didn't take good care of as best care as I should have. But come the springtime, I put them out in the backyard, plenty of sun, plenty of acid rain, and the plants recovered. They were like three or four times the size that they were. I took them out, and I would come up to my neighbors. I say, "Hey, I want to show you what acid rain's doing to my poor plant." And they're looking at a very healthy plant, and I convinced them that acid rain is killing this poor plant, and the power of suggestion. It's really a very simplistic way to brainwash somebody. And they're looking at this healthy plant, and they're agreeing that acid rain is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And I point out, I said, I'm pulling your leg here. I said, you should have seen the plant when it was inside the house, when it was out here in the acid rain. It's doing great. In fact, acid rain really was considered poor man's fertilizer. And so that led me, to have a much better understanding of this. And there's always got to be something to scare people. I was in the post office the other day, and the clerk, really good guy, conservative-minded guy, he actually was an engineer. And he said something about, oh, Trump shouldn't pull us out of the Paris Accord. And I said, do you know anything about the Paris Accord? I said, it was unconstitutional. He had no business doing that. You can't just sign an agreement with foreign nations and expect us to comply. There's something called the treaty process. So it wasn't even an agreement. It was an accord where basically we would transfer more money to third world countries. Third world countries would be totally exempt from the restrictions they want to put on the use of CO2s, and it would destroy our economy, and it would shut down the coal mines and shut down the oil fields, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, countries like China and India, the so-called developing emerging nations, would be totally exempt. Basically, it was nothing more but a gigantic transfer of wealth to address a non-problem. But that's just how it goes. So I'm very pleased that there's many more people out there that are exposing this. It was just about a month ago, a Canadian left-wing news source attacked us. It mentioned our Christian family camp, and it said that we have notorious climate deniers at our camp, Lord Monckton and Willie Soon, Professor Willie Soon. I like the idea of being, they're not just climate deniers, but they're notorious climate deniers. And I hope Debbie Bacigalupi becomes in that category. She may be not quite a notorious climate denier, but she's probably going to be the one after this meeting, and she gets some more notoriety. In fact, the video she did a class at camp this year, California Wildfires and Agenda 21, and we discussed it. She was on the show about a month ago discussing it as well, and the class received, I think, close to 40,000 views, and I think 25,000 just in the last 28 to 30 days. So we're very happy about that, and we just hope to keep doing this, and that's really what we have to do. These echo chambers called the mainstream media, not everybody believes it, but we have to be out there presenting the other side, the truth. And that's why, we have these YouTube video collections, playlists on Agenda 21. We have a playlist with Lord Moncton. We've got a playlist with Willie Soon, Professor Soon, and Debbie Bacigalupi. And these are important because we need you to share this information. And a lot of people, once they get the information, they just bombarded by the left and they don't know another side. And you just calmly present it to them. And it's not our job to scream and yell at people and call them dumb or misinformed or brainwashed. It said, look, this is the reality. Here's some information. Are the sea levels rising? We'll go to the beach. The beach that you've been going to for the last, all your life. You see the tides, unless there's a storm or, some kind of unusual weather, it's pretty normal. There's a little hot dog stand in South Boston on Castle Island. It's at one time was an island. Now it's been landfilled. So you drive out there and the tide level comes up, but it never goes over where there's a little man-made pier, fishing pier. It doesn't rise above a certain level. It's pretty consistent. And I understand that the sea levels have gone up 8 inches in about 150 years. That's not too bad, considering 8 inches is, pretty insignificant. I tease people and say, oh, it's because of all the yachts that the left owns, like John Kerry and John Henry, all the yachts that are on the water, causing the water to raise a little bit. That's what's causing the sea to go up, not climate change or what have you. This past November, we had in the Northeast one of the coldest Novembers on record, with not just cold weather, but snow. Well, why is that happening? It shouldn't be happening if we were into this climate change. We hear about all the ice melting in the Arctic, and it's just the opposite. There's more ice. It all depends on what you're looking at. And you see pictures of ice melting and say, oh, my goodness, we're all doomed. But even if it melted, so it melts. I mean, is it going to destroy the world? Will New York City be underwater at high tide because of it? It's ludicrous. But they have to scare you, and it's always more government. Every time they scare people, it's more and more government is the solution. Here in Boston, we had this – I talked about this recently, too, this stupid ban on plastic bags. I tell you, these globalists, internationalists, must get a big kick out of the gullibility of the average American, stupidity. Where, they're bringing their little recycle bags and thinking they're saving the planet, or they buy these little smart cars, little death traps. They're nothing but lawnmower engines around plastic, and they think they're being smart and they're saving the world and saving the world from climate holocaust because they're driving these little dangerous vehicles. They really must laugh themselves silly behind closed doors. I have to imagine that's what they do. I can see these cynical people, these cynical elitists, they must just get a big kick out of the dumb Americans. They really do. Well, I want to change topics just a little bit here. And now that we're in the Christmas season, Christmas is just, actually it's tomorrow. So I hope all of you who celebrate Christmas have a great day. But the cultural Marxists never sleep. They want to destroy all vestiges of our Christian heritage. And I was very glad that at the Massachusetts State House, this is the third year in a row where they had a nativity scene, the manger, and they had people reading from the Bible coming up, and they had a choir singing Christian hymn, not just, Santa Claus and White Christmas, but actually songs about the birth of Jesus Christ, because that's what Christmas is about. It's not about presents. It's not about the season of giving. It's about Jesus Christ, who was born in Bethlehem, and because of him, we were able to be redeemed by accepting him as your Savior. That's what it's all about. And it's got nothing to do with there's a lot of good things around. People tend to be a little more generous. They might be a little more interested in their fellow man, but it's all about, that's not the issue. It's about Jesus Christ. Now, those who accept Jesus Christ as their Savior, then they would be more inclined to be generous and loving, not just during the Christmas season, but year-round. But I love what Reverend Kraft, our good friend Reverend Kraft, talks about. He says, next time you hear someone say happy holidays, ask them what holiday they're so happy about, this idea of secularization of our religious holidays. And the word holiday means holy day, but people don't realize that. But anyway, getting back to the State House, Governor Baker was there, and we got there. We videotaped most of the program, and before that, Dr. Paul Jaley of the Plymouth Rock Foundation gave a wonderful tour of the Christian history of the Massachusetts State House, and he said every State House has similar history. Not quite like Massachusetts, but definitely Christian history. And he was very interesting. He said that he does tours every so often at the State House. Now, he's based out of Plymouth, Massachusetts. He's the head of the Plymouth Rock Foundation and also has a school, a Christian school, K-12, at the Cedarville. And he's also the pastor of the Cedarville Church. I think it's a Baptist church. Not sure. Anyway, he said he was giving a tour, and there were about 50 people, and they're in the hall. He's talking about a mural that was put there at the State House during or right after World War One, at least our involvement in World War One, and it was a mural of women mothers praying. They're on their knees praying, and there was a Bible verse written. And he was talking about this, and somebody walked by who was an employee at the State House, and he stopped and he said, "No." He said, "This is a secular building." He said, "There's no such mural here. It wouldn't be permitted." And he simply moved out of the way, and he said, "There's the Bible verse right there." And this guy was shocked, didn't believe it, didn't until he saw it. And you know, if you don't have to look too hard, but you have to look. You know, you have to be able to be a little observant and see things like this. You know, there's a statue right across the State House, and it's the 54th Regiment. That's the first all-black regiment that fought in the Civil War. There were a lot of all-black regiments, but Massachusetts was the first one to organize, 1863. And prior to them going down to Virginia and other South Carolina and other theaters of the war, they passed the Beacon Hill, and they had white officers. And there's a beautiful bas relief, I believe they're called, right across from the State House, and it shows Captain Shaw, who was actually killed in one of the battles, and it had the black soldiers marching. And above the soldiers is an angel. On the back of the monument, there's a verse from the Bible. And most people won't even notice things like that. And some murals of the State House, too, you see, even some more recent murals. There's a statue that was commissioned in 1976. That's not all too long ago. And keep in mind, Massachusetts was run by the Democrats for a long time. They had a Democrat majority. I don't think there's been a Republican majority since the 50s. And in order to put these things in the State House, it's not just you go to a yard sale and say, "Hey, some state reps, this might look nice in the corner. Bingo, put it there." No, that has to be approved. There has to be a committee that has a study, and then they approve it. Really, the stuff's not put in there haphazardly. Anyway, it was a little statue of creation, the hands of God. It was very fascinating. And some of these things people walk by every day. And somewhere in your neck of the woods, you might see something like that. Harvard University, you could go different parts of your country and see such similar things. But you have to be aware of this stuff, you know, and see it and say, "Hey, there it is right there. I didn't even notice that." You know. So we have an incredible history, incredible heritage, and we do not want to lose it. And one of the organizations that's working very hard to destroy our Christian heritage is a group called CARE, the Center for American Islamic Relations. Now, go online and put down CARE and Confederate monuments, and you will see them advocating that these monuments be removed. Now, I don't know about you, but if you're trying to convince me that you're friendly, you're Muslim, and you're Islamicist, and you want to be accepted in this country, you don't want people looking at you suspiciously and not trusting you, then I don't think you go out of your way to destroy our history, whether it be a statue of Robert E. Lee or a marker in George's Island in Boston Harbor. I don't think you want to be going out of your way to destroy the history or put it under Orwellian memory hole. But believe me, the Muslims have been doing this, or at least I should say an element of the Muslims, not all Muslims, but the element of the militant Muslims have been doing this for years. And I was doing a little research on the Black Hole of Calcutta, which goes back to the 1700s in India. It was a prison, and there was a number of people put in this prison. It was, I can't remember the exact number. It was built to hold whatever it was, a couple of hundred or five or 600, and they put a whole lot more. Many people died. And there was a monument put there by the British in the late 1800s. And by the 1920s, the Muslims up to it, and they removed it. They removed the statue or the monument there to commemorate that event. And so that's happening around the country, and it's really up to us to say enough's enough. And in a few days, I'm going to be visiting the Massachusetts archives, and we're going to demand some answers. They took down a marker that was simply commemorating the 11 or 12 Confederate prisoners that were incarcerated on George's Island. I did a little video this past spring, early summer, where I went out there and I showed where the marker used to be. I had pictures of the original marker. It was really nothing more than a granite slab with, on George's Island, here are the men who died here and their rank and where they were from. It was put there by the Daughters of the Confederacy, which is an organization based in Richmond, Virginia. They wouldn't get back to me on it. There used to be a chapter in Boston many years ago. You see, there were a lot of the Confederates after the Civil War moved up north because that's where the jobs were. We're now all one country again. And they were still honoring the history of their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers. And they had a chapter in Boston. And they raised the money, and they got the permission to put this marker. And it had been there for a while. It was about 1963. It didn't bother anybody. Didn't cause any riots. Didn't cause any drive-by shootings. It didn't promote gang warfare. It didn't sell drugs. It just there as a historical marker that this is what these of the men. It didn't say the South shall rise again. We want to bring back slavery. None of that. In fact, the commandant of the prison treated the Confederates relatively well. And the officers who were the Confederate officers actually gave their son, this commander's son, who was going off to battle, off to war, and gave him a letter in case he's captured that he should be treated humanely because his father is very humane. And that's a history that needs to be told. And so the marker was taken down. Again, it's been there for over 50 years, almost 60 years, and all of a sudden it becomes repugnant. Governor Baker, Governor Jellyfish Baker, covers it up with plywood, and they removed it, and it's in the Massachusetts archives. Nobody will give us an answer, my state rep, my state senator, the attorney general's office, the secretary of state, I think that's the ultimate person in charge. They won't tell me anything. I call the archives, and no one calls me back, but I said, hey, we want it. If you're not going to put it back on the island, we want it. We want to make sure that history isn't forgotten, and we'll put it on display. We'll find a venue for it. And I would encourage others to do, similar things, not to let our history die. And if someone's going to accuse me of being a pro-Confederate, I just remind them that I had several shirtlifts that died in the Civil War. I named my son Nathaniel Bradstreet Shirtliff after one of my ancestors who was a captain and was, I think it was the 12th Massachusetts, who died in Virginia. I had another one that from Brookline, Massachusetts, that died in Louisiana. And there was one, Albert Shirtliff, who was the first. He was one of the first to enlist in Carver, Massachusetts. He actually had to join a Rhode Island unit, and he lost his arm in the Battle of Bull Run, the first Battle of Bull Run. Another ancestor of mine, Roswell Shirtliff, an artist, was the first, perhaps the first officer to be captured. And he was wounded, and the flag he was carrying was used to dress his wound. So I don't buy into this stuff. Oh, you must be sympathetic to the Confederate cause or something like that. No, that's not the case at all. Anyway, we're running out of time. I want to thank you for listening. Merry Christmas to you. So all the listeners here, thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for all you do. And I do encourage you to help support our efforts. You can go to our website and make a donation through our PayPal account if you like this show. And I want to, until next week, may God bless you.